So today maybe we can have a little more of a discussion on spectroscopy. We just completely cut off. So I think actually Igor, in his own inimitable way, had raised some very provocative questions. And one of them was, are we paying too much attention to photoemission and tunneling? And so at least I would say that the workhorse of the photoemission and tunneling experiments is BISCO. And in BISCO, you cleave at the bismuth oxygen bilayer. So you, at the very least, you do not have a charged surface. You're just simply breaking van der Waals bonds. And then it's a question of trying to correlate the results that come out of those experiments with bulk. And okay, I can offer whatever has been done by lots of groups. I believe there is no
5:1 or whatever.
Okay, so that's not a surface reconstruction. This 5:1 is a bulk superlattice in the bismuth oxygen layer. So it is not a surface effect. It's there. And if you look at it, you see it both in the topography in STM, and you see shadow bands coming from that in the photoemission. But once you know about it, you can take care of it. It doesn't bother you. Okay? So we can discuss in depth as to what the correlations with bulk measurements are, okay?
And then this surface stuff.
That's right. So for instance, last time I had shown this result of Ali's, okay? And said that, okay, I don't have that picture from his papers, but we can go and look up from there, that he can plot out the temperature range about TC up to which a certain fraction of his sample shows local superconductivity, and the locus of those, at least until you go very, very underdoped, agrees extremely well with his own colleague Fuanong's Nernst effect data. And this is by no means the only comparison, and there are many other things. I mean, there's lots of cross comparisons between photoemission and tunneling, okay, photoemission and neutrons, photoemission and optics, and at least in BISCO, things look consistent.
But are we to take this as some intrinsic inhomogeneity, extrinsic inhomogeneity? I mean, okay.
I will defer to Mac on that.
I don't know the answer. But I mean,
suppose it's an actual, honest to God, inhomogeneity of extra oxygen or something else. Are we to take it? There are regions that are perhaps 30 angstroms in size that really have a stronger bearing scale and or put it this way, not even bearing scale, have
Doug, the answer seems to be yes. Now, whether that's because there's very large variations in local charge density, or because of some interaction effects being very locally different, I think is not sorted out.
But isn't it true that if you go on up in your graph,
yes,
you get to higher temperatures,
yes,
than the peak,
yes,
TC.
Yes.
So something is formed, apparently.
But not for the, I mean, it's all, I think it's nomenclature, but I mean this T star or pseudo gap line is higher.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So, in fact, this is a very good...
It's one of the reasons why it's a little suspicious.
No.
So let us look at this, and we can go and look at this paper to know exactly what the temperature scale is. But it's a very telling plot from Yazdani's work. This is the conductance map at temperatures way above TC. We can look at precise numbers. And this is the gap map at temperatures way below TC. And there is a complete anti-correlation between the two. By that I mean the following. If I look at this point, I'm going to get a very large gap at very low temperatures. I go way above TC, and I find a very low conductance at that point. So, in fact, Ali said that his students found this, and it's amazing. They can tell by looking way above TC where the largest gap is going to open up in their sample.
Suppose you have suppose this is some intrinsic effect where you have, you know, a real phase separation, coexistence of two phases, and, you know, it terminates at some sort of second order point. I mean, this is the type of thing that we see in our simulation.
No, look, I think at the 5 nanometer scale, I wouldn't want to call it phase separation.
No, I understand. But Coulomb interaction won't allow that. But, and suppose it's stabilized by the disorder or the inhomogeneity of the sample. Is there some way, does theory tell us whether incipient phase separation or static phase separation should be more favorable for superconductivity?
So I don't have anything particularly useful to add on that. I mean, actually, there isn't a whole lot of theory on very strongly correlated materials with disorder thrown into boot.
Well, you've done some nice work.
That's true. And maybe I will talk about it tomorrow now that you brought it up. But that's not what I'm supposed to do today. I'm not supposed to talk about my stuff today.
Well, look, I mean, from a purely materials point of view, I mean, I haven't done much with crystal myself, but there's no way these things are free of extrinsic homogeneities of some kind in structure or oxygen or whatever the hell it may be. I mean, just it's impossible to imagine that. So this question becomes very interesting. I mean, if it wants to do that naturally, and it might want to form some neat, you know, say stripes, but some more logical thing, but it's not, you know, the surface energies are smaller, whatever, it could easily do that. So, I don't know.
I think this is definitely not stripes. I mean, there's nothing one-dimensional.
Because
even...
that has a more specific meaning.
Yeah, right.
Some phase separation.
There's some sort of defects you can exclude, because if you heat it up above whatever pseudo-gap temperature, above any characteristic temperature, and then cool down, then if this is sort of intrinsic, then it should appear at new random places. If it's tied to defects, it should appear at defects.
It is tied to defects. That's an experimental state.
Yeah,
so same location, cycling will not change it.
Yeah. But suppose that isn't it also how to read it really? What stays part of the sample when you have a larger gap?
Yes.
Why do they have smaller conductivity at titanium?
Because there is a pseudo gap. There's a suppression of spectral weight at low energies at precisely those locations where a large gap is going to open up.
Large gap is
deepens.
Bigger pseudo gap and smaller conductivity.
Yes.
That's what
they mean. Well, do you know whether this background that looks kind of two straight lines?
Yes.
Is that? How does that vary?
So that, yes. Maybe I show that again tomorrow, because we have some. But here is the general idea, that the asymmetry in the background grows with underdoping. And Davis has studied this greatly.
Does it plot some measure of that? What would it look like?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Because whatever that's due to, and there are various ideas, it has to be fundamental in some sense, because it's tied to the fairness of the chemical potentials.
Yes.
So it moves around, and
yes.
So you know that. It's interesting to know whether that tracks, but whether that has the same kind of pattern.
Okay, so that I don't know, but we can send an email and find out from these gentlemen.
Go on.
Okay.
Only because of time.
Time. Okay, so this was, so we discussed all this, so maybe we won't do this. So today I was supposed to talk about new stuff. I just addressed Igor's question, I think, which is a very important one. Which is, so let's look at photo emission. So the two big questions, and I don't think they were much discussed at the conference, but I think they are really being discussed in the HITC community, because they're very controversial right now, is one is the question of the energy gap and whether there is one scale or two, by which I mean everyone and every measurement agrees that the maximum gap goes up with underdoping, and the question is whether in the single particle spectroscopies there is some scale that seems to follow TC as you underdope or not. That's one question. And the second question is this photo emission observation dating back to a decade, that if you look in the underdope region, so pretend this is the phase diagram, which is not, but if I cross T star and I'm about TC in this region, then the full Fermi surface gets apparently truncated into Fermi arcs, which shrink with temperature, eventually becoming the point node in the D-wave superconductor. And so one of the big questions that everyone really would like to know is, are there really things like Fermi arcs? Or actually, is there a hole pocket so that the arc has a closure, but the RPS intensity there is so low that people are not able to see it? But I think the evidence on the temperature dependence is so strong that I'll show you that even if there are pockets which RPS is not able to see, they would then have to have some very strange temperature dependence. Okay, but so let's look at this.
Aside from the temperature dependence that you already...
Yeah, so I think one of the issues is how to extract the gap in photoemission. Okay. So I think one clear thing is if you go deep in the superconducting state, then these are photoemission spectra as you go along the Fermi surface. One thing to note is you have sharp quasi-particle peaks. And so figuring out what the gap is a much simpler matter when you have a sharp spectral peak. Okay? And now here I show you very old work of the Campuzano group saying that if you make spectral function fits to this data, this sort of data, this data later, then you get a gap versus Fermi surface angle as shown by the red points. On the other hand, if you did not want to make any fits and just wanted to look at the midpoint of the leading edge, okay, then you would get, I have plotted the open symbols. So I think the D-wave nature is, of course, evident in both, but when you have a line width, then clearly the estimated gap from the location of the peak is higher than that of the midpoint, okay? And that, again, is something you can see very clearly from here.
That's true. Yeah. Conventional tunneling and conventional superconductor.
Right.
Very hard.
That's right. And so then the question is, deep in the superconducting state, this the idea of making some simple BCS Brillouin fits to the low energy part of the spectral function seem to work just fine. But as you heat the sample, okay, so now there is one other thing which should be explained here. So the photoemission is measuring the A of k comma omega chopped off by the Fermi function. Especially at the node, then the Fermi function plays a very important role because actually the peak is now centered, or the spectral function peak would have been centered at zero energy, the chemical potential, and it's chopped off by the Fermi function. To get rid of the Fermi function, there's one simple trick. If you can, another way to view it is just a visualization trick, is to just symmetrize the data. So just artificially add A of this I of omega to I of negative omega, and that's the way a lot of photoemission data is plotted. Then you can again see that if you look at overdope sample, you see the gap is kind of closing on you, so that at a large temperature way above the TC, you get one big broad peak, whereas when you go below TC, you see the Bogliubov quasi-particle peak emerge out of that. But in the underdope samples, clearly something quite different is happening. The gap survives well above TC. And the way in which the gap seems to be disappearing as you go to higher and higher temperature is not because of the closing of some energy scale, but rather the filling up of spectral weight. And so now, just characterizing the gap as a function of temperature, or indeed about TC, as a single energy scale is itself fraught with danger. You must not only talk about what the scale below which spectral weight is suppressed is, but you should also give some information about how the line widths are changing on you. And you would get very different pictures depending on whether you tried to make some kind of a fit or just plotted a leading edge. So some of the confusions in the data just come from different people do different things, okay? Okay, very good. Now, here is a set of data. This is from the Stanford group. This is from the Argonne group. And the samples are nominally similar, underdope 67K bismuth 2212, underdope 65K bismuth 2212. The Argonne group says that the gap, so long as you are below TC, 20 Kelvin, 44 Kelvin, 62 Kelvin, looks essentially like a D-wave gap. okay? And only when you cross TC, the arc opens up. And now here, they are defining the gap as 1/2 the distance between the symmetrized peak to peaks. Okay, the Stanford group, on the other hand, plots its data slightly differently versus cosine kx minus cosine ky, and finds that over a whole range of angles on the Fermi surface, they follow cosine kx minus cosine ky. If they had actually followed it all the way, in fact, the value of the gap also wouldn't have been too different from the one here. But then suddenly, as they approach the pi zero point of the zone, you see a marked deviation from cosine kx minus cosine ky. Okay, and part of the issue here is related to what the data actually look like. And the question is, okay, I don't know where the chalk. Oh, sorry, was that the right light? Okay, so as you underdope, the quasi-particle peak becomes very small. So if I plot this as the spectrum at k equals pi zero versus omega, the question is, do I have this or not? And if I lose this quasi-particle, then of course the gap I measure will look considerably larger. Okay, and I think it is true that most situations that I have seen raw data on, where you see marked deviations from cosine kx or cosine ky, it coincides with the loss of a coherent quasi-particle peak near the antinode. Now, why this is happening in some samples, not in others, how reproducible it is, I don't really know. Okay, so I think there is some real difference in the raw data, not just in the number which is being pulled out. And perhaps one explanation is that when you start underdoping sufficiently, disorder effects become important. Disorder is known from a variety of methods to impact the antinodal regions much more than it does the nodal regions. And as you lose the antinodal quasi-particle, the estimated gap, you're not looking at the gap to some coherent piece of the excitation, you're looking at some higher energy feature, and that's what's responsible. I don't know if this is true. Okay, this I think we will have to settle as time goes on.
Of course, the proto-emission mistake, state the obvious, is averaging over all that other stuff that we were talking about.
See, this is also a very interesting point. You're absolutely right. Photoemission is averaging over all of that, because you have a tens of micron by tens of micron patch in which you're illuminating and collecting, or maybe even hundreds of micron to 100 micron. But in any case, I think all photoemission groups, so this is from Shen's group, it's the same story, that you have a point node until you hit TC, and then you open up an arc. On this, everyone agrees. Okay, and also I think everyone does agree, even the STM people agree, on the temperature dependence of the arc. We can argue whether the extrapolation of that should or should not go through the origin, but the fact is, if you look at, as soon as you go about TC, an arc opens up. As you raise the temperature, the length of the arc increases. This is from the Argonne group, and this is the arc length versus temperature from Seamus Davis, says from this. So even if there's a pocket that photoemission is not able to see, and actually even tunneling is not able to see in the way in which they are trying to pull out the Fermi surface from quasi-particle interferences, that pocket would somehow have to be strongly temperature dependent. Okay. Now, here is the question that Philip asked me. Yes, please.
TC or temperature dependent?
T dependent. So the picture is that, okay, maybe this picture helps, that you have a point node until you reach TC. As soon as you reach TC, you find that the point node flattens out into an arc. Or if you would prefer to see raw data, okay, I forgot to put this on a full screen. You can see it just without any things. But if you look at low temperatures, you see a D wave gap. This is still below TC, I see a D wave gap. When I go above TC, I see a gap on part of the Fermi surface, but all these green curves are gapless. And then I go to 115 Kelvin, and the gapless extent of gapless curves increases. OK, Okay, so then this is what Philip asked me about. There is this very recent paper from the Chinese Academy of Sciences from Zhou and his students, which looks at a different material. This is BISCO 2201 and claims that when they do very high resolution laser photo emission, they see a tiny peak. So you can see that the main peak is not visible on the scale, and then there's this little tiny thing that comes up, which they have marked in red, and that's this. They say that, look, everyone else has been looking at that, that's the arc, but lo and behold, we actually have a little pocket. And I don't know, you can even say that they have both an arc and a pocket, actually, by looking at their data.
Because the arc length is longer than
The pocket.
Than the pocket.
That's correct. So, so what the meaning of this pocket is very unclear. There's one very strange thing about this pocket, okay? One way you can get pockets is through symmetry breakings. Right? Either you can look at the 5x1 reconstruction, or you can make some other charge density waves. Then, since the Brillouin zone is actually changing on you, you fold back the bands and you get pockets. So with Mike Norman, we were trying to see if any symmetry breaking would give us this pocket, and it seems to us you would really have to fine-tune to do that. And the reason is the following, okay? That this end point of the pocket here seems to sit at the pi by 2 point of the zone. That's really surprising as to why the pocket should close exactly that way and no other way. And if this data stands up, other people are able to reproduce it, then I think this is something we will really have to understand.
How similar is it to Peter Johnson's beginning of finding the curve back?
I don't believe his pocket would go through the pi by 2 point, because I think actually his pocket is surrounding the sort of anti-ferromagnet. So it's, if anything, if I use my imagination to make that pocket, his pocket would, the pi by 2 point would be right in the middle of that pocket.
So this in some sense is more like Rice Company.
So this is certainly true that Maurice Rice, Fu Chen Zhang, and one of the students have a paper predicting exactly such a pocket.
It's not predicting. They just did some phenomenology.
Yes, they did some phenomenology many years in advance of this observation. Okay, it's true. It's a phenomenology.
But isn't in their work the pocket,
yeah,
the point where Green's function actually goes to zero, the spectral function goes to zero?
Yeah.
You're absolutely, I was about to say that. So, okay, so two things to say. Let me say one thing about what they did, and so which is, their claim is that the way in their scenario, Luttinger's theorem is satisfied, is by having the Green's function at zero energy diverge on the locus of this little pocket. But then, obviously, you cannot satisfy Luttinger's theorem, so then they have the Green's function at zero energy vanish on this entire line, which they call the Unklapp surface, and then together they are able to satisfy Luttinger's theorem, for whatever that is worth. Okay. Now, as a result, Zatko is absolutely right that precisely at the pi by 2 point, the intensity should be zero, whereas Meng et al. Certainly find an observable intensity at the pi by 2 point. So if you look at a detail like that, it is this problem.
But just to make a comment quickly,
yes,
that Fuchan's functional form for the self-energy is not purely phenomenological. They looked at ladder simulations and extracted this form from that.
Sure. No, they have multiple motivations, but for the 2D plane, it's proposed as a phenomenology based on several motivations that they have. Yes.
I'm just curious, actually, can we learn something about the problem from completely different type of measurement from orbit, or it wouldn't tell you anything?
So the problem is that most of us don't know quite how to understand all of the Hall effect data in this strongly correlated material. We cannot appeal to multi-bands to rescue us there. But we can just throw up our hands and say we don't, because there are sign changes in the Hall coefficient. Okay? And so in a single band system, if you see sign changes in the Hall coefficient, then that means something quite complicated is going on, and we, at least I don't know what.
So in the arc scenario, there was a natural aspect that the arcs just grew and eventually got a full.
Yes.
Here, how would the buckets even evolve in temperature?
They wouldn't. Because actually, Morris Rice and company are quite silent on the temperature dependence of their self-energy. So that's just a phenomenological statement. And as far as the experiment grows, I don't know how much temperature dependence they have done and what kind of consistency they would find with all of the other data. And not just on BISCO, actually, Fujimori's group has done LASCO also and found Fermi arcs that grow with temperature. So even if I were to say, look, an arc is an impossibility, okay? Of course, at zero temperature, it would be, I would think. But at finite temperature, there's a closure. It simply means that there's some very temperature-dependent phenomena which is going on.
So on the other points in those books, I see plenty more points in the arc.
So actually, if you look at the paper, there are a whole slew of points, and a lot of them are related to what Professor Chomsky was saying. There are superstructures and so on and so forth.
So my question was, are the other lines understood? They're kind of building structures?
So actually, I don't understand how you can get so many different things. But you know, some of them are very, very intense, and some of them are very...
The line labeled LPS is supposed to be the shadow band of the, the LS line is supposed to be the shadow band of the main peak. And that's curved this way. Right? Could you point that out? Right. That thing
so,
right there.
So Philip is pointing to this.
Okay. That's supposed to be the shadow band of... Could you point out the real band? Okay.
Why don't you come here?
No. Well, you're there. I mean, just pointing. You can do that. Okay. So you're right there. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, you had made the point that a shadow band should not be curved opposite to the actual band.
Oh, it can be.
Okay. So you now think that it's okay for this to be the shadow band?
I didn't say that. I simply said it can be. That simply depends on what the Q vector is, Philip.
Okay.
Okay.
So is the Q vector right for it to be that way?
Look, actually, this particular material I know rather less about, but I think this has some CDWs and all kinds of other stuff going on. Okay? So I don't think this is a really well-understood material. But no matter what you do, I find it hard to believe something going through pi by 2, because then that's fine-tuning. Anything else I can, you know,
okay, so
by choosing some Q vector.
Forget about that feature.
Okay.
I just want to understand a feature that supposedly doesn't require any exotic physics, namely a shadow band.
Yeah.
Do you know of any materials in which shadow bands are observed that have this sort of...
That have this? The answer is yes.
Where?
Okay, so I can show you BISCO 2212, some very early work of Philippe Abi and others where you saw that. In fact, initially, it wasn't here in the zone, okay? It was elsewhere in the zone, but the curvature was like that. And initially, people thought that there was some kind of anti-ferromagnetic order. And then there was a whole series of careful experiments that showed that actually it was a structural effect.
Okay. Okay.
Wouldn't it also have been very simple?
No, so Abi's work is like in the many, many years ago, in 1989, 1990s at that time. That was Osterwalder and Abi, the Swiss group.
Okay, now one other thing about this is that the LPS band.
Yeah.
Okay, they note that there's, well, okay, that's supposed to be the shadow band of this Fermi pocket, of this whole pocket.
Yeah.
Could you just point that out so everyone knows what that is? Okay, now they note that this occurs, this doesn't exist in the most underdoped samples. It turns on at some value of doping and turns off. Okay. Now that is bizarre.
I mean, see, we are looking at ever less intense phenomena in a false color plot. I think Igor should speak up at this point.
But we should also solve tenure to move forward.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So can you, if it's your attraction,
can you go to your next slide instead of me? And can you keep talking instead of me?
Mac, do you have the schedule?
I do.
Well, thank you for all of us.
I think it's emergent spatial structure. Bradkin.
Oh my gosh. Let's do the following. Let's have some people who are physically here.
Okay.
Let's see. Because
I appreciate somebody who was physically lost
yesterday.
You won't go there anymore.
Yeah, but
so we get Philip to do his yet?
Oh, so yeah.
Do you want me to stand up?
Yes.
You can just ask me.
So if you get 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's because Latko took your 10 yesterday.
So that means you get zero time.
But she's showing you what a nice guy is.
Okay,
I'm supposed to.
Since you were watching tennis, I had to cut you off.
Yeah, it's going to take me a while to get set up here. My advanced age, I need my glasses.
What we do have is Eduardo sent some view graphs, and we will see.
Actually, we know that
she's not here.
She's watching tennis, too.
Tennis
is over, Mac.
And you
always
know what happens.
I won't.
Well, then it'll be roll computations.
Right. Okay.
Both here?
I heard it's close.
Mark. Yeah, I'm somewhere in direly need of.
I'm hiding right behind you.
Because
it's
picture of another galaxy.
Is that
He might feel okay. I happen to know what it costs to bring you here. You were watching the goddamn Wimbledon.
That's an important thing.
And in multiple.
It's an inspiration for me. Okay. Okay, so I just want to sort of mention a few things that I didn't have time to stress during my lightning fast talk last week. Okay, so to my mind, there are two sort of central questions in high TC. Why is this region dome-shaped? And but it's really not, as you know, okay? And this will come up later on. And then how does Fermi liquid theory break down? You know, we have this strange metal, and I come from the school of thought that you have to understand this stuff before you can talk about this stuff. Okay, so what I want to do is...
$1 million
the answer? Yeah, this is the $2 million question. Okay. So what I want to do is try to address this question of why is this dome-shaped? Now, this, of course, would require that you know something about superconductivity, but I want to focus on something which has a drastic signature right around the top of the dome. Okay, and that is the thermopower. Okay, so here is a plot of the thermopower at room temperature, 290 Kelvin.
for a range of cuprates, essentially all of them. And in this region right here above the solid line, the thermopower is fit to this functional form. And then below this line, it is a linear function. And the thermopower for all of the cuprates can be fit onto this universal curve. And note, it changes sign right here at 0.23 doping. Okay, so the planar hole density is just corresponds to what you would normally think of as x. Okay? Now what they've advocated is the following. Since really only for LISCO, since that's really the only stoichiometric material that is a cuprate in which each strontium corresponds to one hole and hence you can get the hole count exactly, they advocate, since the thermopower is this universal function, let's use this function to calibrate to determine the phase diagram rather than the Presland empirical formula, which we know works for LISCO, but is an extrapolation to any other material. So using this then, so what they do is you measure TC and you want to know what X is, rather than using that empirical formula, just go and read off what the value of the thermopower is, and that will tell you then the corresponding value of the planar hole density. Now using that, they then plotted the maximum value of TC as a function of the as a function of the corresponding doping value for all of the cuprates. So in this scale, of course, LISCO still lies out here. It's 0.16. But for most of the cuprates, the sign change of the thermopower pretty much is right in the middle where you have the optimal value for the corresponding optimal value of the doping at which TC is maximized. Okay, so it would seem then that understanding why the thermopower is changing sign at 23% doping is not unrelated to why TC is becoming maximized. Okay? Now, one thing they did do, so this is the empirical formula. I don't think you can, all of you know this. This is the thing that fits the dome that everyone reports as the dome-like feature. It really comes from just this empirical formula, which we know only works for LISCO. And what they're advocating is, don't use this. Go and use this as a way of calibrating what the doping is. And it should be, and since it's a universal function, it should tell you something about the phase diagram. Okay, now, one thing you can ask is, there are independent ways of counting the number of dopants in the cuprates. And these methods are summarized right here. For example, you can use NQR, AMRO, NEXAFS, you can also use ARPIS. And what they've done is, the scale that they have determined from the thermopower, they then make a correspondent. They simply plot what you would get from these other methods, and it's pretty much in excellent agreement. So this lends credence then to using the thermopower as a way of calibrating what the hole density is for cuprates, which are essentially non-stoichiometric. Okay, so the question I want to ask is, why does the thermopower vanish at 23%?
Before you get there, could I ask?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we use the scale that you just told us, thermopower. And suppose I plot the TC of YBCO.
Right.
During that, do I see the difference?
Yes, you do. You do.
Because I know Walter Hardy and Vaughn used another scheme of trying to correct for this density. And when they did, they saw the dip. So.
Okay. Yeah, so.
You can see a dip.
Right, you do. And let me tell you something. What Walter Hardy was trying to do is he was trying to address this issue of is this empirical formula really valid for YBCO?
Right.
Okay, and it turns out that in one of their plots, they actually had to calibrate using that formula. So their work is not actually internally consistent. In other words, they didn't come up with an independent way of counting the holes in YBCO, independent of the Preslin formula.
I see. We can look at that again together.
Yeah, I can.
We phrase it a little different, but they do it, but maybe specific to what you're doing. If you do find the dip, then it seems to me that's further support for your formula.
Right, no, it's, okay, this is not my procedure. This is the procedure of Hanma and Hor, which I have sort of latched onto because of this observation that with this procedure, the thermopower changes sign exactly at optimal doping.
What's the temperature this thermopower?
290 Kelvin.
And there is a low temperature dependence of sign. Like you keep the doping and change.
There's some, but the thermopower will change sign, even if you look at a wider range of temperature.
So you're focusing at a low temperature, just low temperature.
Well, I'm focusing on, so the question arises, can you understand why the thermopower is changing sign at room temperature?
I mean, it says the thermopower is so sensitive to the topology of the surface. Is that one quantity which is not very robust? Just bringing back my.
Well, the Hall coefficient is very sensitive to the.
I thought the thermopower is the same thing.
The thermopower is a fairly different measurement. It's certainly also sensitive, but in a slightly different way.
Thermopower
and
simple tools measure the dependence.
Okay, so can I go on? Okay, so the thermopower, okay, here goes. I have a tutorial on the thermopower, okay? Okay, now, why am I interested in the thermopower? So the thermopower, you simply just apply a temperature gradient and you measure the corresponding voltage difference across the sample. Okay, now, to some extent, the thermopower is a measure of the entropy per carrier. Okay, so if particles and holes have the same entropy, then you would say the thermopower should be equal to zero. Okay, now this is not exactly a correct statement, okay? Let me tell you exactly how you would calculate the thermopower. So in terms of these sorts of Onsager relationships, the thermopower is really a ratio of these two quantities, okay? And so it's really a moment of the scattering time, and the scattering time is expressed here, okay? Now, since it's the first moment that appears in L12, the thermopower will be equal to zero if this function is symmetric around the chemical potential.
Sorry, just a quick comment. This is the lifetime approximation, no vertex corrections.
Right, I know.
It's just a strongly correlated system of like.
Well,
cringe.
No. Well, tau, I mean, you could, it's in here, and you've made no approximations in whatever the spectral function is.
So
there are vertex corrections. So this is the lifetime approximation to the thermopower, okay? Okay, so within this, okay, the thermopower, you can understand a vanishing of the thermopower as a symmetry associated with tau, this lifetime, being the same below and above the chemical potential. Okay, now, if your spectral function is independent of momentum, then a new symmetry emerges, namely that it's really a symmetry, then this integral, hence what it really is saying is that the density of states is symmetric around the chemical potential.
Density of states times the velocity, which is opposite.
No, but this is squared, okay? That's squared. Okay, so it's really the, so, let's ignore that. If the spectral function is momentum independent, then it's really just and this is the first moment of this. Then it's A of omega, which is just the density of states around the chemical potential. That's the quantity.
Times the velocity squared.
Yeah, but that's.
Just as much density of space.
Well, the velocity doesn't depend on omega. Okay, you're doing an integral here over omega.
You're summing over the omega.
And I think there's also no reason to assume that scattering rates are less frequency dependent than the density of states. So there are several other reasons. Even without Gödel's corrections, that's not a valid approximation to replace it, to take a frequency independent scattering rate for inelastic problem. So we are inelastic scattering, right? Not elastically scattering.
I did a lot of calculations for just regular materials.
All right.
Simple materials. And it's very rare you can actually measure the density of states. You have also rotation rate, thermal velocity, and density of states, and they all change on the same level.
Maybe we should allow.
So
that we move on. Mark had one question.
Just a comment. We find that at this point, where you find the symmetry, mm-hmm. that the self energy is remarkably flat.
Right.
Can you bootstrap that into saying that the charge vertex is also largely K independent? In which case, there would be no vertex corrections.
Well, okay.
We have to move on only because of time.
How much time do I have left?
None.
Okay, so let me. Okay. So now what I want to do is get to a formula derived by Benny a long time ago for a Mott insulator in the atomic limit. Okay, and in the atomic limit, you can really just get the thermopower by just looking at the entropy. And what this formula tells you is that it's a very simple result for the thermopower. It's just log of 2x over 1 minus x. This is the exact result in the atomic limit of the Hubbard model. Okay, now this formula is fairly different from the band insulator result, what you all know is the Mott-Hycus formula. In which case x starts out at 2, and hence this thing changes sign at x equals 1. Okay? Whereas this formula changes sign at x equals 1/3. Okay, so band insulators certainly have a vanishing of the, just a non-interacting system, certainly has a vanishing of the thermopower right at the particle hole point in the band. Okay? Whereas for the atomic limit of the Hubbard model, that is occurring at x equals 1/3. Okay, so the question is, why is the Hubbard model particle hole symmetric right at x equals 1/3? Okay, so the answer is fairly simple. It's something that, now what's interesting is that this formula was derived in 1974. And it kind of lay unexplained until recently. And the explanation is spectral wave transfer. Is that every hole that you remove from a Mott insulator in the atomic limit is producing two extra states above the chemical potential. And hence, the total weight, if you just divide by n and you have x holes that you put into the sample, the weight of this peak is 2x and the weight of this is 1 minus x. And hence the Hubbard model in the lower Hubbard band is particle hole symmetric exactly when this weight is equal to that weight, which is exactly 2x equals 1 minus x or x equals 1/3.
Philip, okay. The atomic limit, there's no width to the lower and upper Hubbard bands. There is delta functions, t equals.
So what? So the weight is still 2x.
Wait, maybe to find into your picture.
Who cares about the picture?
Obviously, you don't.
Well, but I mean, it's not only me who draws this picture this way. It's hard to actually put 2 under a line. So if you know, that's why it's written like this. So I could draw 2 here rather than okay.
To get that formula, do you have to? So I mean, particle hole symmetry is important or not?
No. It's the exact result in the atomic to get which formula? Benny formula?
This one is obvious. The other one.
The Benny formula is just derived exactly from doing the t equals zero.
The Hubbard model.
In the Hubbard model, I'm just counting states.
Exactly, particle hole symmetric, isn't it?
It's particle hole symmetric at x equals 1/3.
Yeah. Yes. So my question is, like,
he doesn't put particle hole symmetry into his calculation.
It's that something like effectively looking at lower cover bent and looking at where the curvature of lower cover bent that can say. And if you do it in simple Hubbard quantum coupling, you get something like 1-0. But I'm not sure that really goes good way to treat this.
No, I mean, the Benny formula is the exact result, okay?
It might be explanation of that, but...
Okay, so what happens next? It was a very, very generous 5 minutes, Philip.
Okay.
So you made your point.
Okay. So the point of it is, and I'm not sure I understand what your objections are, because...
Later.
That is... Okay, let's go on. Okay.
Maximum PC.
Okay. Okay, so the point of it is, I'm done. Okay, so my point of it is, this is not, this term right here is not just 2x. It's bigger than 2x. And as a result, the atomic limit of the Hubbard model, the sign change of that is the maximum value of the doping where you would see a sign change for the Hubbard model. And in fact, so this quantity is bigger than 2x, and that's the dynamical part of the spectral weight. The fact that their antibonding states transfer down from the upper band, and that's increasing the weight above the chemical potential, and hence it's increasing, it's lowering the value of x where you actually...
would be that you get a higher TC.
Why is maximum TC?
Okay, so my point is, since the actual experimental value is 0.24, it's telling you that the dynamical part of the spectral weight is important in the sign change of the thermopower. Ergo, it's important in TC. Okay?
Okay. So for example, with the new materials we're coming, we might look for where they have zero thermal...
Absolutely.
...at room temperature.
At room temperature.
And you might suggest, based on this, that that would be where TC was high.
Right. Okay, here's a calculation in the Hubbard model. Okay.
I think then we can discuss calculations.
We're only high for large U.
Right.
No, but I have now corrected for the large U limit. I'm saying you need to look at...
What I'm saying is that in a high TC problem, you have kinetics, T prime and T double prime, these are all relevant, right?
That's fine, but those are... I'm not ignoring those. I'm just saying that if you put in finite T, you have to have a transition lower than 1/3. Who cares? I mean, it's if you go and do the Hubbard model at U equals 8T, you in fact get a transition at 0.24. If you want to go and put in T prime, it will be, you know, slightly different.
Okay, we're ready. Igor, you're on.
There you are.
So, Mark?
I never need a lecture.
Okay. You know, we need microphone for different reasons, because it's sort of written on stone for ages. Anyway, so Mark and I took assignment seriously, in the sense that we are not supposed to speak about our own work. So, so we came up with this title, and does it? Okay. Wait a sec. Yeah. So there was implicit. Yeah. Actually, Mark protested about putting Shakespeare quotes in, but I thought that they are a couple. And also, I felt jealous that they were Shakespeare was quoted in the conference. So I said I can come up with 3 quotes which are relevant for our for our conversation today. Anyway, all right. So let me at this point. So this was will be okay. The structure will change roles. So I think Mark will tell a few. Okay.
Hmm? They said it should be.
Yeah. So he will say a few words about the ball.
Still attached.
I'm here.
So, I mean, many people think that the rise of computational science has been driven by you know, the rise of computer power. And to some extent, that's true. I mean, if you look, when I first came here to Santa Barbara, I believe that we had a VAC 780. Now, we had a vector processor attached to it, and it was the first MIPS machine. And roughly, you could say a MIPS is a megaflop. And the machines now, you know, your laptop has maybe 57,000 MIPS. The research chip that Intel is making now is a teraflop. And of course, we're now writing proposals and regularly using machines that run at a petaflop. This is a factor of a billion increase in just my research career. And Igor likes to point out that it's a factor of 10 billion in his research career that does this. So this is driving computational science, which is an emerging interdisciplinary discipline that uses computer simulations to solve problems. But it's not the whole story. David Landau, a good friend, and a guy who's been doing computational science and calling himself a computational science forever, made this curve. And forgive me, I didn't make it. You can barely see the axes. But what it shows is a linear scale showing time, and this is when he began in 1970, where he initialized everything to 1, or he normalized everything to 1. And this is a logarithmic scale that shows roughly power. And this is the top 500 list, the LINPACK list, showing the rise of computer speed. And this is kind of cool right here. There's a kink, and that's the massively parallel era, when everybody had to, you know, go from vector codes to parallel codes. But this line, this is a log scale. This line is the complexity of the spin system that he can simulate. And some of the points are his that he's particularly proud of. And notice it has the same kink here, because people had to rethink their codes at this point. This gulf here is huge, because this is a log scale. This is the brain power of the computational scientist coming up with new formulas and algorithms and codes. Even if computer power hadn't risen dramatically in this last 20 or 30 years, we would still have a massively more powerful field able to do more complex problems. And Igor and I tried to come up with some of the things which are driving this, the concepts which are driving our field, not necessarily spin systems. Dynamical mean field is cluster extensions, linear response theory, Carparinella, continuous time Monte Carlo has been a particularly relevant thing here, maximum entropy methods. And I really like these new hybrid methods, because I really think they're the direction of the future. Steve gave a really beautiful talk about a hybrid of DMRG and some ideas that underlie Monte Carlo. There's a really nice method, strong coupling continuous time quantum Monte Carlo by Philip Verner, where he combines exact diagonalization in Monte Carlo. LDA plus is a good example in GW. Switch roles again. It takes two to tango.
Right. So we'll come back, if time allows, a little bit more of that. But this is a very important thing, in the sense that car goes only as far as there is a driving behind the wheel. And it's a trivial thing, but sometimes it's so often not really understood that you do computations in order to be able to think, and not you think in order to be able to do calculations. All right, here I was, there's a little bit of chart, and of course we all now, basically there's no paper which goes without calculations at all, taking integral solving differential equations that you derived, I think is trivial, we're not speaking about that. We are speaking about non-trivial calculations, which non-triviality may be defined as indispensable. So the calculation is provide you something which you cannot really get in any other way, and that answers the question why. So there are two. So we are trying to come with a little bit of classification. So there are two branches. One is sort of on this side of the screen, and the other will be on that side on the screen. So why do we first principle calculations? That's the main thing, the main attraction here is that they are material dependent. So far, this is the only way to build material dependent theory, is to start somehow from this sort of first principle calculations. You can go a little bit with matching some model parameter experiment, it gives you a theory which is specific of a particular material. Relatively rarely it gives you a theory which is actually material dependent. The other side of this coin is this interactable theoretical models. By which you mean, like, for instance, the example that Mark will speak more about, this equation which was raised several times, is there supernativity in the Hubbard model or not? The Hubbard model is a very clean, simple model. Unfortunately, most likely there's no way to answer this question analytically at all. The only way to answer it is by doing numerical calculations of various sorts.
Right. And there's recoupling, at least, we are pretty sure that there's either superconductivity in the problem. That's pretty much established. It's not mathematically rigorous, but I think it's pretty sure that recoupling, there's one.
Okay. I'm not saying they are class of models which can be. Again, there's class of questions which are strong coupling Hubbard model. There's other examples you can come up with which don't have
sometimes
answers.
We know the Hubbard model is superconducting. Dino is superconducting.
Well, why don't we hold off on these questions for just 2 minutes?
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me now go to this. What do we? If we do these calculations. What do we really learn from there? And here I want to refer to words by Volker Heine, who wrote that, I would say, probably about 30 years ago, that computations that just agree with the experiment are worthless. And actually, this is quotation by memory, so I'm not, but I think it's pretty close. He said, how often I read a paper about a piece of computational physics which finishes with words, and we obtain good agreement with experiments. If you know the answer from experiment, I want to cry. Why you are wasting so much time calculating it? Just to prove that God believes in the same Schrodinger equation as you? Well, that might seem trivial. There's something which is actually less trivial, and people surprisingly rarely understand that failure to obtain agreement in first principle calculations may be, and usually is, as informative as as ability to obtain the agreement, for the reason that we understand, by now we understand rather well what are the limitations, what are the actual physical, what's the physical meaning of these calculations. And as long as we understand that, it's good. If they disagree with the experiment, that's fine, we learn something. Let me give you an example. So this is example from our business, very soon. If LDA underestimates tendency to magnetism, that's a very sure sign for Hubbard correlations and mode transition. If LDA overestimates tendency to magnetism, that's actually exactly opposite. That's a sign of quantum criticality and spin fluctuations. So in some sense, if LDA fails to describe the real material and we know in which way it fails, it provides us with invaluable information. Now, to some extent, similar thing, albeit different, can be said about this sort of calculations that Mark is presenting here. Yes, it is numerical experiment in a way. Some people don't like the expression, but it is an experiment. It's also psychological experiment. You dive into unknown and you pull out effect. And this fact is a challenge to theory, and this fact needs to be explained, just in the same way as experimental facts are explained. There is one important difference, and the important difference is that this is, as opposed to laboratory experiment, it's a dissectable experiment, it's analyzable. If you are good, and if you know what you are doing, that usually you can actually, there are exceptions, some sort of Monte Carlo, but usually you can go back in time, in step, and understand where exactly and which way this answer appears. That's invaluable. Advantage of this numerical experimentation compared to real experimentations. So this is a little bit about this philosophy. Now, point of concerns from consumers, those who were here yesterday probably remember this slide. It changed very little. So the question I was asking yesterday about some of the experiments is, how balanced are the efforts? Do we have a balance in the way to talk towards colorful pictures and nice movies? I forgot who was giving this zero talk and said this. I didn't know that this expression exists in English language. Now I'm going to play Seamus Davis, and that meant that I'm going to show movies which were things popping up and down. Who was that? I don't remember. Somebody used that. in some sense, it's equally applies to all of us. It's very tempting to go into more and more details if you know how to run these calculations, probably beyond the limit when your time and computer time and your students' time is wasted on extracting tiny and not really insightful details. How careful we are separating the consequence of method that we choose from physical results. Mark will give a beautiful example of still, if I understand, outstanding problem about the Supermartini-Hubbert model, where methods which on outset seem to be both well-defined and very reasonable actually give very different results. And I wonder, Mark wanted me to put it in red, because he said it's the most important thing of our presentation. Our job as theorists, your job as theorists, try not to tell computationalists what they should be seeing. I know it's hard, particularly if you happen to be both.
Exactly the same warning as the experimentalist, yeah. Computationalists replacing experimentalists.
Yep.
I get it.
Now, there is a it's a shaky ground, and, in principle, we know that professionals and experimentalists are best judges of experimental work and so on, but there is always this, you want to have at least some clues about whether how reliable a paper reporting experimentalist. So there are some of the clues that we thought about. First of all, if you see a paper, let's say band structure paper, where you see there's no technical description. They don't tell you what method they're using, what exchange correlation function they're using, how many K points, whether they check convergence with this and that. That's one red flag. And that applies equally to other numerical techniques. The other things, if the author do not say anything about having check the convergence, they may not be able to do that, but if they don't even say that, you know, we did calculation, that's the result, that's another red flag. We say, no, we check convergence with respect to this part, number of K points, number of time steps, but you were not able to check convergence to this and that, that's okay. If the results suddenly agree with experiment or theoretical concept, while others, other people don't get the same result, and in the paper there's no explanation of why the calculations are better than what did they do differently. And finally, if sensitivity to model parameters is never discussed. So we used in our model the parameter W double prime, which we took equal, just without loss of generality, 1.378. Thank you. That actually applies to theory, to analytical theory papers just as well. But anyway, and finally, there is a control parameter that known to exist in the paper, and the method allows for systematic study, or at least some hints of systematic study, and it was not. That's another thing. And as Mark pointed out in this sentence, it's sometimes questions remained unresolved, maybe temporarily, and we should keep it in mind. Okay, so this is one thing which I wanted to put before giving that, because this is this is a cover from Lorenz Dorel book Justine. It happened so that Mark didn't read the book, so he was asking what sort of first principle calculation he was talking about, LDA or something else. Well, he was speaking his philosophical sense. But it's still good. It's mentally vulgar to spend one's time being so certain of first principles. Anyway, so this is...
Can you go back, Igor, to where you had your upper right-hand corner? No, keep going. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's fine. I know what you mean when you put an X through that. But as an experimentalist, let me say... What you're saying is these are things that are well known, you can do them, whatever. They're not always left in a way that the experimentalists can do them. I mean, they're just, it's so hard to actually do it, even if you can conceptualize it. So I just want to point that out. But as things get routine, and we should be able to do them ourselves, and I'm not objecting to that. But it's nice when they're good interfaces and so on and so forth. And I don't know how that's going to get done.
Well, I mean, you told me.
It's not for here, for instance.
But I know exactly what you're talking about. I have a paper which I'm sort of proud of. It's a nice paper, PRL, on hydrogen under pressure, where I did some of the theory. But also, I actually did processing of experimental results in a way they were not doing before, accounting, and having some fitting procedure accounted for pressure gradient inside the sample, which, and only after that you were able to extract the phase transition.
Well,
and this is
the first crude LDA or whatever else. And
yeah.
You're saying that these methods which we're developing have to be made more portable, more accessible in some way. Some interface to a portal.
If they're heavy, and there's no reason for it.
I think
that's not enough.
You're taking care of this for you, because they strongly reward computational scientists for providing portals or web portals or friendly user interfaces to the codes that they develop and distributing them to the community.
Well, yes or no, that depends on the field. I think it's a very sore spot that you say. If you look at the band structure codes, which are at the level when they actually can be used by people who are without experts, all of them nearly all of them are from Europe. Hardly anything is being developed in the state, because I mean Schwartz and Blacha can afford sitting there in Wien and working for 20 years on mastering this Wien 2K code, which is a masterpiece, and you know, having students go through them and develop. You cannot do that in this country, unfortunately.
I agree with you about the sustained project. It's simply that type of sustained funding simply doesn't exist in the United States. But nevertheless, if you look at all the recent calls from CIDAC to CDI, from DOE to NSF, they all strongly encourage us to make our codes accessible to experimentalists in particular.
Yeah, but they still will be funded for.
They will not fund it for more than 5 years.
It's going to take some, you know, startup company where that's the way we do it. But I just, that's all. I just want to make a comment. I think, and you.
But Mark, how will you use those? Suppose you have very easily accessible LDA code, and instead of say eager, you would do the same kind of metrics to give it to yourself. But would you get all this? Could you make all the tests which he knows how to do? Could you be really sure that?
Could you be sure that it's really
reliable what you got?
Well, or the answer is no, and therefore, if it's something that is that sensitive, then it doesn't belong up in that trivial corner.
No.
Trivial means it's straightforward. There aren't those kinds of questions. It's hard. You want to get on more difficult or more sophisticated.
The sanity tests need to be built in.
It's like experimental equipment, you know. That 50 years ago, people were building 90% of their apparatus from scratch themselves, and only they knew how to use it. Now we are in an era when most of machinery can be sold. But in fact, if you go and buy STM machine and you put you and me in charge of this machine, I doubt that we will produce anything similar to Seamus Davis data. You know, and the same is true here. But what we're speaking about today, if you have some formulas which involves taking integrals and solving differential equations, you can go use a standard code and get a result out of that. To some, what you are saying is that some of these sort of physical programs should be moved toward this situation when you can do these things.
There's exactly the same, in a sense, revolution has taken place in purely experimental things. I mean, when I started out, you know, we had major heat capacity here, you could transport there, but now we have this thing called PPMS, and physical property measuring system. You buy it for $100,000, it works 24 hours a day, and it makes all those measurements. So what are we doing? We're out there making scanning probes and all this other stuff. So that we're like you in that regard, but I'm just saying PPMS really works easily, and you can run it 24 hours a day, and good students and modest students can do it. When that little corner is in that, we should aim towards something where that corner is like that. That's all.
Is there a package which does something like, you know, lattice, tight binding band structure, and a whole bunch of relaxation time approximation and basic, you know, sort of Boltzmann calculations? I mean, that's something that could be created. Given how much theoretical discussion takes place at that level, that would be very useful.
Right.
That's where the phenomenology comes in.
Yeah. This is interesting. They are sophisticated first principle packages, but this thing everybody has to write that from scratch. You know, if you had to do tight binding, and it's not a big deal to write, but it would be nice to have it. Yeah. But then the question is: suppose that you have a student, and would you or postdoc, would you set your postdoc to spend several months of life to do that while they could be writing papers and securing jobs?
So I believe the problem. Division of labor. Since people in Europe have stable funding, the architect can find someone and he'll write it, and they can maintain it. It's a global planet. Why should we?
It's not the issue of stable funding or not entirely. It's also largely the issue of how people actually find jobs in Europe and how people find jobs here. There's much more emphasis here on the number of publications, citation index, and these sort of things. Well, in Europe, it's more done on the personal connection. If your professor is very happy with you, he probably can place you. That's another thing.
Second part of
the talk.
Well, I think this is the last slide.
Well, I have one more slide. You don't want to vote. Anyway.
This is an example of the... This is an example of this last point. Sometimes questions remain.
For people who are watching the web.
So sometimes questions remain that are unresolved, hopefully temporarily. And one thing that's come up several times is this question about, is there superconductivity in the Hubbard model? And this is an unresolved question. Calculations that we did, sort of in the intermediate to weak coupling limit a few years ago, seemed to indicate that there is a finite TC. And here we looked at one over the pair field susceptibility here on this axis versus temperature on this axis for a bunch of different clusters. And the high temperature result here, of course, is the mean field theory, which would be the Forsyte cluster. And you can fit a D-wave plaquette on a Forsyte cluster, so therefore there are no phase fluctuations.
What is the vertical scale? What is the vertical scale?
One over the pair field susceptibility.
So when the pair field goes to infinity,
it goes to zero. And then as we increase the cluster size, at first it fluctuates around, so when we have an 8-site cluster, it clearly goes to a negative transition temperature. But eventually when we get large enough clusters, and these clusters are really characterized by the fact that each plaquette is surrounded by four independent D-wave plaquettes, then the transition temperature seems to converge to a finite number. And I think this would be very consistent with your observation, for example, because this isn't too far out of the weak coupling limit. So that would be a finite transition temperature, and it's D-wave. On the other hand, there was a calculation done by Massa and Mata's group using a complementary approach, which is this Gaussian quantum Monte Carlo. And there you just directly take the Grassmann algebra and you map it onto a Gaussian basis. And you do the simulation in that basis, so there's no minus sign problem. Now, there are a number of intermediate steps that you have to do to make that mapping. But when they look at the pair field susceptibility here for U equals 6T, but they also commented about 4T in the paper, what they find is that the pair field susceptibility rapidly falls to zero, and this just remains at zero. Excuse me. They looked at the relative pair field susceptibility. That is the difference between the pair field susceptibility for 6T and for zero. And this would indicate that there simply is no long-range order in the Hubbard model. So how do you reconcile these two? Well, they're complementary approaches. They're complementary starting points. Here, both approaches are an expansion around the local, some sort of local approximation, where 1 over the linear cluster size is your small parameter. But here we're doing an expansion around dynamical mean field. And here they're doing an expansion around the atom, if you will. And also, we're using complementary approaches. Here we're using Hirsch-Phi quantum Monte Carlo. And here they're using this Gaussian basis set quantum Monte Carlo method. Now, I was really hoping that Matthias Troyer would be in the audience because he has significant experience with this technique. I don't. So I can paraphrase what some of my friends have said, but I'm not an expert in it.
Yeah, but those are fairly different.
Well, I don't know what the dope is. Is it 0.9? Is that
dope
level? Is it 0.1 in the upper one?
Right.
See, it's much larger than that.
Right. But notice as they go to larger clusters, they have smaller doping. But the reason they did this is that...
Do the more control thing. Let's...
Let me explain. This method really only works for closed shells.
But in the size of clusters, you can do it. They can.
So they can do significantly larger clusters than we can. But remember, we're doing an expansion around dynamical mean field theory, so there's an additional cost due to the embedding.
This is a bit of a distraction, but should I read the second panelist saying that the superconductivity is weakest for the dreaded one-third doping?
One-third doping.
Well, 0.28.
Yeah, okay. Now, I think, look, they're looking at a larger value.
Limits. Who cares about that?
Yeah. They're looking at
0.2.
You used the limit.
Shut up. That was to show you that there at least had to be a sign change, okay?
But I think it is legitimate because they are approaching a region where you would, for this value view, expect to see superconductivity. And you don't see superconductivity. And I would say, really, these two methods right now are irreconcilable. I think my friends who've worked in this area have some criticisms of the Gaussian Monte Carlo. What they say is that, yes, it's correct, but to make the mapping to the Gaussian basis set, you get a huge variance. And so, for instance, you know, if you have some quantity which should be 2, it might be 1 for quite a while, and then shoot off to plus infinity for a very short amount of time. And that type of calculation has actually been done. So it's not really clear that this method is convergent. Now, in defense of what Masa has done, he's not doing a simple calculation like that. He does precondition this calculation by using an unrestricted Hartree-Fock preconditioner.
What can you do? Look at the other susceptibility. Like rather than chaos susceptibility, look at the spin susceptibility, for example, if they see like some kind of a negative.
You know, I don't know. I just looked at the paper a few days ago. They technically can't look at susceptibilities. They can only look at equal time quantities. So they can't look at zero frequency quantities, just zero time quantities. But that's still okay. You should be able to see with a zero time quantity pairing.
In your calculation, so for the single site, we have this notion that an appropriate infinity limit thing. So when you do clusters, is there an equally rigorous mapping onto something where it's exact?
No. The only place where this becomes exact is when the cluster size goes to infinity, and the control parameter is 1 over the linear cluster size square.
And you're just doing the whole system.
Okay. Mark, just I know there's no solid or no precise answer to this question, but you were talking about how fast things are going up. Say 10 years from now, is this going to be trivial? Is this problem going to be solved this way?
It depends if they can get the heat out. Seriously, that's the problem. Well, and it also depends whether we can get our codes to scale to 100,000, a million processors. That's where we're headed. Monte Carlo does not scale well when you get beyond 10,000 processors, unfortunately. There's an inherent problem with it. It's the warm-up problem. As you take a calculation and you make it more and more parallel, you can never get rid of the amount of time you have to spend warming up your Markov process. Oh, so eventually it becomes dominated by warm-up. So then you have to make a hybrid parallel Monte Carlo codes where you take advantage of, let's say, multiple cores sharing memory to do one Markov process, and then you minimize the node communication by having separate Markov processes on different nodes. And this is what we're doing. We can get to about 20,000 processors that way. But we have the monosign problem then that kills us.
I wouldn't be surprised if 10 years from now they would just new methods.
Yeah.
New
computational method.
Physical computational method. Sure. But for example, I don't understand. I was just chatting with Sasha Lichtenstein recently about this, and he said that here again is that people should work now on combination of analytical approach and numerical approach. Like you do DMMC calculation and develop analytical methods to sort of treat the remaining error analytically. Maybe there's truth in this way or something else.
So we're doing something like this where we take the problem, we separate it into different length scales. We treat the short length scales explicitly and intermediate length scales with a Parquet approximation, which is a huge calculation, and then the longest length scales in mean field theory. This is one way of getting around it, but I think another way of getting around it, which is very promising, are these hybrid approaches. Steve presented one. You saw another very promising hybrid approach is the so-called strong coupling quantum Monte Carlo developed by Philip Werner. That name doesn't do it justice because it really is a hybrid approach, because first you do an exact diagonalization, and then you of a small cluster, and then you perturb in the coupling of that cluster to its environment. So it's a combination of exact diagonalization to solve the small cluster and a diagrammatic quantum Monte Carlo to solve that perturbation problem.
Can I have one more minute? I don't necessarily want to speak about it. I'm sure, because this is a question that I was asked by many people, so I thought that it might be a good possibility to answer, but then I realized it probably will take more time. So I just formulate a question and the answers. And there's one issue that people seem to be very interested about. What are all these methods that are derived from density functional theory? 15 years ago, there was essentially one. Now we have quite a few of them. And in fact, there is systematization and general physical background, which is not always appreciated, particularly because one big part of them are things which are coming from chemical community. So this is what we had before. Now there's a big hybrid branch. And many people who are doing that because they're chemists, quantum chemists, they don't really understand that they're still doing Hohenberg-Kohn theorem, but basically the physical difference, and it requires, if anybody needs, I can show you how to prove that most of its exact exchange method, bleep method, hybrid Hartree-Fock single method are actually Hohenberg-Kohn method with different interacting fictitious systems, which is used to search for density. And that's an interesting thing. In principle, that's interesting way to develop that in a systematic way, the other branch is the self-consistent or not expansion in this quantity. So basically, this method based on the similarity between Kohn-Chem equations, which have this operator essentially, and Dyson equation. And then these various approach approximations for this guy here can be used, and that would give you GW, SIG, LDA plus U, and I'm not exactly sure because I didn't really read through that. A very recent approach, which is called LDA plus Goodswiller, but this is another class of thing. And the thing that you as consumers should remember, that when you deal with this sort of method, as opposed to this hybrid branch, these methods are often called LDA plus something. People like this LDA plus. In reality, it's LDA plus something minus something. So basically, the best example is LDA plus U. In LDA plus U, you add Coulomb interaction in Hubbard sense, and then you have to subtract the actual Coulomb interaction in Hartree sense, which is computed much more accurately. So in those cases where sort of Hartree approximation is reasonably good, you can only make it worse by doing LDA plus U. And the other thing is that since you add something, you have to subtract something, it's not unique and can actually be worse approximation than the original. That is famous double counting problem, which also exists in DMFT, by the way, and unappreciated. And the third branch is the methods which are sort of conceptual, derived from CPA, from effective media approximation. And these are DMFT from GW that Gabi Kotler is so excited about, and some others. So this is just a little framework, only because it was
often comes up.
You are quite fair to quantum chemists, actually. So they have their own ways to go beyond idea like waves.
Well, that's exactly the point I was making.
Continuation
waves and so on. Convergence is something totally different.
Yeah, that's what I mean, actually. That's really what none of us or none of you guys can do.
Yeah.
So what you do is one letter determinant.
Right.
And that can never explain, for example, that can never describe figure.
And then there are cluster things which are similar. What I meant mostly was these things like bleep, string, whatever it's called, and this type of functional exchange and so on, which is very, very, very popular in quantum chemical community.
I don't know, but at least quantum chemists can go beyond many categories, beyond what let us tell. That might be crucial for some chemists.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Who else?
This one. Exotic mechanisms.
Okay, so I think I'll just use the board.
Beyond the Hubbard model,
you can imagine, right now, screen cut.
Did I?
Oh, they weren't here.
You might want to use the microphone.
When I heard that there was an exotic session in the superconductivity conference, so what I assume people will be talking about would be this idea that you can get high temperature superconductivity by being near a spin liquid phase. Okay, so at least that's one proposal that was very popular several years back. I think it turned out that none of the talks in the conference in that session were about that topic. Right, so maybe what I'll do now is say a few words about that, and that got me interested in sort of looking at the literature and seeing what's the experimental evidence for that kind of mechanism. And maybe I can just report about what a web search revealed. And again, maybe since it's an open-ended question, this is not necessarily the only exotic mechanism. If people have other ideas, we can talk about it. Okay, so I guess this the essential idea, maybe I'm not sure who to attribute it to, but Anderson certainly popularized it a lot, that if you have a spin liquid phase, you're an RVB state. So in some sense, this is an insulator, of course, but the cartoon picture is that you pick pairs of sites, you form singlets. These singlets are resonating around because it's you've sort of established half of the superconducting correlations that you're interested in. You formed singlet pairs, but of course it's an insulator. Now, if you allow these singlets to move around, you could end up getting both pairing and phase stiffness. You'll end up getting superconductivity, and the pairing scale will be typically set by the exchange coupling J, which could be very large. Okay, that's the essential cartoon picture. Okay, so people made a lot of progress in understanding spin liquids theoretically. Okay, and really this mechanism only works if the spin liquid is a spin liquid with a spin gap. Okay, so you can also think of spin liquids where there's no such spin gap, either a full spin gap or a partial spin gap. But it's only when you get spin liquids which have this sort of spin gap, when you dope that, you might expect to find the sort of higher temperature superconductivity. Okay, so.
Why do you make that distinction?
Okay, so for example, one of the
popular spin liquid candidates is what Kanoda talked about, his organic triangular lattice, organic magnet. And the best theoretical proposal, which involves spin liquid physics, is this projected Fermi C. Right, and that's a state which has no, that's a state of spinons in a Fermi C, but where there's no spinon pairing, at least no local spinon pairing. Right, so
in this context, of course, the thing that was discussed early on was, Affleck-Marson type, which is not a full Fermi surface, but nodes.
So it's not so clear. Yeah, so that's why I said, either full or a partial. So Affleck-Marson would be like a partial Fermi, partial spin gap. Strictly speaking, there's no spin gap, but it's, there's a lot of gapping of spin excitations, and you'd expect on doping to get a D-wave superconductor. Of course, you could imagine also having a full spin gap. Okay, but not this kind of the thing that projected Fermi C. So for a projected Fermi C, the magnetic susceptibility is actually more or less the same as in the conducting state. There's no such local singlet being formed. Okay, so in fact, if you look at the experiments that so now the question is there any experimental evidence for this?
Can we stay at the top for just a minute?
Okay.
Is a two-leg ladder, in any sense, a spin liquid in an RBD, or is it something else?
Okay, so that's a good question. I wanted to say that too. So, if you really think about this, you don't necessarily need that these singlets are resonating around. Right? The essential thing that you're using is the fact that they are forming a spin singlet. Right, so, okay, I don't know if there are, maybe people in this audience know more, but I think also a state like a valence bond solid state, a state where, spins come together to form a singlet, but they're not necessarily in a spin liquid state, that would be probably as good in order to get this magnetically mediated pairing. Once you dope that or, by some other means make it conducting, you might again expect to find the same mechanism being operative. So I think that, multi-leg ladder, that's essentially the physics, right? That there's some sort of dimerization that's being driven, by...
Same meaning higher TC or high TC?
Yeah, high TC, where the essential scale that's controlling, at least the pairing is of order the magnetic scale.
Well, I think the initial idea is that, you wanted the doped objects to be pretty two-dimensional, so you want them to go into a spin liquid so that they're not, in a columnar state or something, you might imagine that they go into stripes or something like that. So if you look at Phil's original paper, his notion is that he's going to think of condensing in the classic BCS fashion, like the valence bond, delocalized over all sides into a zero momentum state and then macroscopically sort of occupying that.
Okay, so your objection to this might be that because there's some, let's say you actually form a one-dimensional structure, the superfluidity also might be one-dimensional. Okay, but I think it's not necessary. It could be that, if you have, you might have something that's anisotropic but not quite one-dimensional.
Fluctuating in more fancy proposals since, but at least the initial idea, which is encapsulated in the RPB mean field theory, is the sorts of wave functions that Mohit has worked on and so on.
Yeah, so in all of these, if you have very low superfluid density, it'll be controlled by the doping. But still, you're already making a lot of progress, right? You've got J of order several hundred Kelvin, and could think about how to dope it enough. So anyway, let me take these as being both, viable ways of, looking for this sort of mechanism of higher TC superconductivity. So what's the experimental evidence for starting out with states like this and doping them, or by some other means making them conducting? Okay, so I would like to think of doping, but also actually another attractive option, which is what Kanoda talked a little bit about, is by using some other parameter, for example, pressure, to drive a Mott transition. Okay, so you lower the charge gap just by this means, and again, you can get a conducting state. Okay, and can we actually end up with a superconducting state? Okay, so now it turns out, of course, there are not that many examples that we have, or even candidates that we have, of spin liquid states. And surprisingly, actually, there are not really many examples of valence bond solid states either, okay, at least of spontaneous formation of valence bonds. There are examples where the lattice itself dictates a certain valence bond pattern. But anyway, all of these candidates are, you know, it's not a huge class. On top of that, if you require that you have this additional knob, the list gets whittled down.
There are many spin pile systems, for example, which can be also classified.
Okay.
If you like, all molecular crystals are valence bond.
Okay, so, you know, if you're really deep in that limit, you can just think of some collection of molecules also, if you like, as being valence bonds, right? But
yeah,
clearly this physics wouldn't have...
Which can exist both in regular way or dimerized. There are many materials which dimerize to spirals or spin spirals or quite a lot.
Yeah, but do you know any of them which have been doped or which have, you know, where you can cross a Mott transition?
Mott transition might be... Well, there are some actually.
Yeah, so I'll give one example.
Well,
but,
once again, copper germanate, which is a classical inorganic spin pile system, and people doped it also and looked what happens.
Okay, so I'd be interested to hear what
they
happens there.
They don't become metallic, unfortunately.
Say?
They don't become metallic, unfortunately. They are too low dimensional.
Yeah, so maybe I should say 2D, right? Valence bond solids in 2D, dimerized things in 2D or 3D. And if you really want.
Separation.
Yeah, or you just get some molecular, you know, crystal, right, if it's really very strong. Okay, so the few examples that so for spin liquids, the three examples that people give, one is this organic that Kanoda talked about. And then there's actually an inorganic compound based on iridium. Okay, so I'm not giving you the exact formula over here. This is by Takagi's group. No, this is called the hyperkagamy, so this is three-dimensional. Okay, thanks. And then there's also a kagome-based, this is Herbert Smithite. So now it turns out that these two, for both of these two, the proposed spin liquids, which I think are the most serious proposals, are actually spin liquids which don't have the spin gap. Okay, so even experimentally, if you look at them, there are many low energy excitations. It doesn't really look like there's some gap opening, both in magnetic susceptibility and in specific heat. For this, there is, you know, the proposed spin liquid that people have proposed is actually a spin liquid which has a partial spin gap, but nobody has actually succeeded in either doping it or putting it under pressure and making it a metal. Okay, but both of these people have actually made them into metals by either pressure or doping, sometimes both, actually, with this particular case with both. But the results are not published. As far as I know, there's no superconductivity in this material, even when it becomes conducting. And maybe it's, even from this viewpoint of spin liquids, it's not that surprising. This is a superconductor. The phase diagram that they plot, function of temperature and pressure. Okay, so there's something they call the spin liquid. And as you increase pressure, there's a phase transition, and then you get a metallic state, which is over some wide range of temperatures. And finally, at the lowest temperatures, at around, I think the highest TC is around 2 Kelvin, there's the superconducting state.
I think it's 4 Kelvin.
I think I got 2. Maybe I'll just check my notes. Maybe you're right.
There are two materials. One of them is this.
Yeah, I got 2 Kelvin.
They were antiferromagnetic going into the superconductor.
Yeah.
The other is the spin liquid.
That's right. So the interesting thing is that, okay, this is the case for the spin liquid. There's another, this is all brazed in the triangular lattice. Okay, so there's another very similar compound. It's a somewhat anisotropic triangular lattice. Let me draw it like that. Okay, where you actually establish nail order. Okay, so it's nail. But under pressure, you know, you have the similar kind of transition as a metallic state. And here, actually, it turns out you also get a superconductor, but with a much higher TC. Okay, so it's a 10 Kelvin superconductor. So I couldn't really verify in that short time whether the exchange constants were also pretty similar. I think they're probably quite similar. So in this particular case, at least, in a sense, you don't really expect very strong superconductivity for this kind of spin-on Fermi surface state. And indeed, you find that actually the magnetically ordered state seems to be a better superconductor in this. Okay, so that was for the for this column. I think we, to really check whether this mechanism is operative, we really need more candidates for these spin liquids states. Okay, but for this valence bond state, so maybe this is somewhat less well known. There's actually a candidate from these family of organic compounds where people claim to have seen this valence bond solid state in a two-dimensional system. Okay, so what they do is they have this whole family of triangular lattice compounds, and this particular compound is one where, by whatever means they, they estimate that the exchange constants. So they actually estimate these hopping integrals to be very close to being isotropic. Okay, so the name of this compound, if anyone is really interested in these organic. Okay, so this whole family has got this palladium DMIT group. That's the common guy, and they vary this this part of the chemical formula, and they can vary the kind of triangular lattice they get. Okay, so in this particular case, they via X-rays and magnetic susceptibility as a function of temperature, they say that there's a region where you have a valence bond solid. Okay, so they see a spin gap. The ordering temperature, I think, is of order of 20 Kelvin. That's also roughly the spin gap energy scale. So below that energy scale, you establish this valence bond solid pattern that breaks some lattice symmetry. So it forms something like this. And surprisingly, it forms on the weaker bonds, something I don't understand. The singlets form on these weaker bonds, which is why it breaks the symmetry.
In a sense, longer or what?
Say?
Smaller hopping. Longer? Or?
Smaller hopping.
Yes. Huh?
So they have some way of estimating the hopping strength, and they say, so there are three bonds, two are equal, the third is different and larger. And according to the structure they publish, the singlets are on these weaker hopping strength bonds.
Once again, you have to run bond solids in inorganic material. I can give you at least two examples. We recently looked at those. Lithium VO2, that's one. Then we form triangles, actually, but singlets on triangles. Three spin one forming lithium VO2. And there's another one, I think it was, you have it in Japan, I think again it was sodium. Lithium 2, ruthenium 3. The honey complexes, we form again a transition and formation of singlet below the structural disturbance. Looks like something like honey complex. It's rather funny, but the structure is funny. It's honeycomb. And then you have valence bonds like this.
So it's a spin a half system?
That's spin one.
Okay, so that may be an issue with one has to maybe think about. Because these are actually believed to be spin one half. But, maybe it doesn't make a difference. But, yeah, so I think it'll be interesting to look at these materials also and see. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, that was what I was coming to. So, so under pressure, this actually was studied under pressure. So let me give you the reference for that, which I think is quite a nice paper. but not very well known. So I didn't really know about it until recently. Okay, so the phase diagram they find under pressure is, again, as they crank up the pressure, you get a metallic state. There's a phase transition into a superconducting state here. The transition temperature is not that high, but it's higher than for the spin liquid example. It's around 5 Kelvin, the maximum transition temperature. Okay, now, is the valence bond solid order present over here? I don't know. I couldn't figure it out by looking at the papers. point that you can see over here, which is sort of a nice contrast to this the spin liquid case. So in the spin liquid case, if you look at the phase boundary between the metallic state and the spin liquid state, it bends this way. Okay, so the spin liquid has more entropy than the metallic state. But over here, the phase boundary bends in the opposite direction, which is sort of consistent with the spin gap.
Is there natural way to think about this is that you're increasing T or what?
Yeah, that's right. So T over U under pressure, T over U is
getting bigger.
That's right, getting bigger. Probably because T is getting bigger.
Yeah, same thing. You see that, at least in the, think of that as actually collapsing any sort of Mach gap. Right, so that's very different from the idea that you would keep Mach physics for the valence bonds and.
No, but when you say collapsing the Mach gap, it's not that different, right?
Homogeneously, though, you're sort of. So, for instance, if you had, as you approach it, you're adding terms to the magnetic Hamiltonian, right? Which are longer and longer range. You're probably creating magnetic structure with certain range, but doing all of that and then going metallic. Different from. Especially if you think of slightly inhomogeneous.
I see what you're saying, yeah. So you're saying doping a few holes is not doing that much to the magnetic Hamiltonian.
Right. Probably. Even for doping with a few holes, RBB theory is pictures, but and then there's wave functions, but the idea of when you even put in a single hole, from Nagaoka that the effect of a single hole actually can lead to create some very large-scale objects.
That's
not
right.
At all clear how to get into a regime where the hole is actually fairly mobile from a picture of the valence bonds. Mm-hmm. It's always been a very seductive cartoon. Mm-hmm. And there's RBB mean field theory in which you can leap all of this and get lines.
Right, or slave bosons or something like that.
Yeah. Pressure is another game altogether with that.
Well, just one experimental observation, it's ironic given the disaster Stern was for all of us, but there are now far better ways and very amazing ways of field effect doping. That would be really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Try it on all these materials.
Then you don't have disorder.
Yeah.
I have a naive question. This valence bond in real life, they very strongly couple with lattice. And people still work on that. Is it ever taken into account? Is there any idea of how strong effect it will? This works against this valence bond.
Delocalization, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, there's probably some polaronic physics that may be very low doping that dominates and makes it an insulator.
So in the context of Seamus Davis and stuff, that's actually an interesting observation, which Steve Kibbleson's Eduardo has thought about, the fact that the canonic coupling could in fact stabilize valence bond patterns.
It usually happens automatically. So in this structure that Danny described, there's usually this very strong dimerization, so the length of the bond is very different. Just working around against lattice is usually very hard.
And the trouble is that what exponentially cuts down the ability of things to move.
But in principle, you can hope to suppress these kind of things, for example, by pressure. I know yet another thing, by the way, which in inorganic triangular lattice has been one half. It seems to have something like your left corner picture. Sodium, titanium, O2.
But with orbital degrees of freedom as well.
Spin 1/2, which has also metal drive transition, in which is diamagnetic low temperature, parity and fraction is often. Nobody tried to dope it and nobody tried to apply pressure.
Well, the fifth is actually...
But it's got orbital degrees of...
Portfolio of low temperature, metallic excitation, but not superconductive for them.
But with some orbital degeneracy.
Yeah, yeah, but the orbital order gives you some one-dimensional knowledge.
Right.
And then in this one-dimensional belt, you form
five
of
them.
Five of them.
Seems to me it hasn't been pursued.
Experiments.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no. Well, it's starting to, I think, certainly in the organics, not even in the inorganics, but certainly in organics, it's in that whole subset of experimentalists has sort of drifted off into their own. I'm not criticizing them, or we've let them drift off.
Question, is it possible somehow that we get the slides? I realize, or should we, some of us, just record this if we've heard? Do you have anything on slides of this?
No, I don't.
No, I understand. Okay, good.
Well, can I ask you a question? Do you remember in Kanoda's talk, he actually said the material which was a spin liquid had the lowest?
It had lower TCs.
Lower than the antiferromagnetic.
We also had, and the frustration, well, I guess that's.
And it's not only a low energy magnetic state, but they also have, say, in optics. Optical gaps is filled really in this spin liquid state. There's no real gap in optics. Whereas for those, for the one which is terminal order, there's a real non-target like gap in optics. Mm-hmm. So there are also, the gap is filled also by charge expansion, not only field.
Yeah. But by DC transport, it looks like an insulator.
No, it looks like insulator, but without clear insulating gap. Mm-hmm. Not good, of course, also, but also not clear. Please make sense.
Right, we have one more.
Well, it depends on whether you want.
But I could say something on the cold atom side, so, but that's knowledge. So,
yeah. Well, also, these interesting superconductors that are made of iron and nictitate materials, and they are rumored to have 60 Kelvin transition temperature, as opposed to, say, 2 Kelvin.
Yeah, what about them? Do you want to talk about them?
But I, of course, could, but there were about 1,000 papers written on them, so I was wondering, is there some discussion of that or not?
There was supposed to be some.
Well, what was supposed to be a discussion? You were in for
it. Well, you're here.
No, I see.
So suppose you could... Nick, I explained it to the company. With your name?
Yeah, fine.
I don't know.
Yeah, I guess Andre and I were on.
Who yeah.
You weren't on the radio. Andre is deserted and I'm left here. We'll work it out. I mean, I think we should talk about
it. I have a feeling.
Maybe you can do it tomorrow.
Tomorrow, oh, yes.
Geez. Tomorrow. Let's
think through what's happening.
Well, just once again,
CFP through the.
Okay, yeah. So at least now, and the group who's here, let me get this right. We have an announcement out to tomorrow.
Yeah, it's on the wiki.
It's on the wiki, which I think no one knows how to get at.
If you go to our website and click wiki, click schedule, you'll find it.
All right, but tomorrow we're meeting in this room at 9:30 to get a jump on the Andy DeSitter work that will go on, space work that will go on at
9:30.
11:30. Sorry, Joe, 10:30.
10:30 or 11:30? We moved it back, it's 11:30.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
So Mohi will talk to us at 9:30, and then at 11, there is a discussion that we talked about, and at that discussion group, Igor will discuss with us a title, it's his title, and I should remember it, but it has to do with S plus minus the S plus plus.
and there are a few other words in there I don't quite remember. But it's a very nice
topic. You don't talk to Pranav.
And this is going to happen in the founder's room because it's a discussion, because we somehow don't want to interfere with the other program, of which it may be, and Joe, I want to ask you, is the other program going to solve the Hubbard model for us?
You know, the Hubbard model, I don't think that no. No. But,
I hold out hopes after going to today and seeing the Bose-Hubbard model. I mean,
you can write down the ADS model for the Bose-Hubbard model?
If it's all some of us are attending, hopefully it's
the end of the Hubbard model.
Before you all leave, just one last, from speaking as an organizer, we, meaning Eduardo, Doug, and I, would like to phase out of our sort of strong management role. After this discussion, and there's a couple more, we'll work that out. We now want to hear from you what you want discussed. We have a couple of themes emerging from all of you. So, you know.
And the sad part is some of you are leaving at just the time when we're counting on you taking over.
Well, what I'd really like to know is you can have a long tail by talking to people. I mean, basically, we just want to know what are the things that really you all
want. Actually, I'd like to hear a discussion exactly what Zlatko said about the iron superconductors. But maybe we can do it next week.
I'm supposed to not see you next week. I don't know how long it
is. I have to be in Moscow.
There's so much we can do. But
so both of Zlatko and I are leaving, so no new people are coming.
No, Zlatko's here.
I'll be here, but I'll have to leave next week, part of next week, to go to Aspen.
But then you're back after?
Then I'll be back.
But you're not.
I know, yeah.
Well, one option, it depends on how many people want to attend all the center talks. In principle, we can get another informal discussion and we'll allow to do so in founder's room.
Yes,
that's the new option. Maybe we have to do that.
So I would be glad to do that. We have something else arranged for 3:30.
For three.
Let's say we can meet at 1.
What is organized at 3:30 or 3?
It's a social result, so the internal thing is what came about the Barbismo talks that we
join. How about 2 to 3 then?
But 2 to 3 sounds good.
Okay.
Don't include me. Why don't you just agree? Because I will come if I can.
I think in the spirit of the chaos, this has to be informal in some way, simply because there is a real overlap with another interesting
program. Well, these are things that you all say you want, and people come or not as they, you know.
Exactly.
So there's no obligation.
No. Of course, that's the spirit of the place. So we all enjoy it. But I'm saying that
is 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock better for you? Or you have
so
it was weekend.
Tomorrow I have to spend whole day on the phone, unfortunately. So. Next week, you're not around part of next week? Not in the round part of next week. So why don't you just make some agreement and I'll try to make it.
If we go next week, is Monday a better time?
No, we're only late on next week.
Later.
But that's okay. That's okay. Why don't they just they make a deal and I quit on the meeting and see what happens.
Yeah. Many of us would like this. You know, I
Now I see what your question is.
Exactly.
It's the other one, isn't it?
Yeah.
You make it.
Benny and Pinkus, the paper is closed. Benny has his paper, he did by himself.
This was a spotlight on himself.
In the long run, it's not
counterproductive.
Of course it's counterproductive.
No, somebody's got to get up and say, I'm really trying to... Maybe we need somebody who's so kind and just...
Right.
Now, if I start to talk with you, I'm pretty sure that...
The weight above is equal to the weight below, which means there have to be two sign changes for the Hall coefficient in general.
Which one?
One third doping and four third doping. Is not accurate. I mean, there has to be two sign changes of the Hubbard model.
Simple Hubbard like the cut.
Don't do that.
I'm not sure whether they were treated. Mm-hmm. Why? Because that's actually a very naive story when I just think Hall effect as normal. But this can be done. Mm-hmm. Sooner or later it should be. And then my Hall effect should also have a normal Hall effect, but also a normal effect. Then I don't know what to do.
Right. No, for either hole filling, hole doping, or electron doping, there have to be each one produces a sign change.
Yeah, no, exactly. But that was essentially, as I said, that was essentially my question. Where? And Hubbard one, they come to give you one third. About that.
Right.
Not exactly.
Because it has to find 18.
Something
but
like.
It has to change sign less than one third.
I understand now that actually a good way to, because I really didn't really follow the count at that time, because it was maybe 40 years ago, but I didn't really have a good clear understanding why,
but it's simple.
It was essentially the same story. If you talk to you, then effectively in Hubbard-Ton decoupling, you have this gear that, one minus n, and then n here. And then something, and then the leg of each thing
changes with n.
It's the same. Taking care of the problem.
That's right.
But as I said, I was not really, didn't publish it even because I thought that, I don't know what to make of it because I didn't know what to do with real magnetic anomaly.
Right. That's
if I do it non-magnetic, that's more or less what I mean.
Yeah, that's immaterial.
If I do it in even permanent ground state, then it might be more complicated story. And Hubbard one the background of function we need. I can do it in principle. It's very complicated. But in principle, and that's essentially why it's not really how fit lower Hubbard one, because effectively, when you start doping, then you transfer factor weight and your weight of lower Hubbard and upper Hubbard change all the time. That's actually the Hubbard now.
That was my second important point in my lightning fast talk during the conference, where I said the thing that you have to worry about is this dynamical spectral weight transfer, where the weight of each of these bands is not fixed.
Yeah, but that's actually, how good is Hubbard one in this respect?
It's not very good. It's not very good.
But not very bad either.
Well, we don't. I mean, look, it's an uncontrolled approximation. You've done a decoupling of some terms in some you know, some equations of motion, and people will always argue about that.
Yeah, I know.
Why it's an unsolved problem.
It gives you a reasonable result for your
Right, yeah.
Why not? I like this kind of thing. Okay, good.
So, my talk is...